Make the world a better place. Make the world a better place.
Hey, hey, I'm Steve Norris. Welcome to Better Place Project, where each week we shine a light on amazing humans from every corner of the planet who are doing extraordinary things to help make the world a better place, including sharing their knowledge with us on how we can be living healthier, happier, more purposeful lives. Once again, thanks to everyone for supporting the show by subscribing so that way you don't miss any episodes. And the best way to help the show is to leave a written review on Apple Podcasts, of which I'll read a couple random ones now. This first one says, I really appreciate the format offered in the Better Place Project podcast with Steve Norris. It is such a pleasure to listen to a long format show where the guests have the time to tell their stories the way they want them to be heard. There is no confusion, no innuendo, and no shortened context to have to sort through. Just a straightforward no gotcha conversation with some amazing people. It's like having these people over in your home for dinner and getting a chance to really get to know them and their story. Finally, my thanks to the team at Better Place Project for putting together a highly enjoyable, educational, and thought-provoking podcast with amazing guests from around the world. Boom! What a wonderful review. Okay, I'll read one more since that was a long one. Let's go with this one. In today's world of horror-based headlines, this podcast is a weekly dose of much-needed goodness. Each week highlights a person who is making the world a better place in ways that makes me realize that inspired ideas can and should be pursued in tumultuous times for the benefit of us all, and absolutely must listen. So thank you again for all of you for these reviews. They really inspire us to keep doing the show week in and week out. Next, I want to throw a shout out to Kara Bitar, who was an incredible guest on the show a few weeks back titled Live a Life You Love. That was episode 75, if you want to check it out. Well, I was so intrigued by our conversation that I signed up for one of her sessions called Manifesting Blueprint. Now, before I go any further, I want to point out that this is not a paid advertisement for Kara's services. In fact, I paid her for the session, but the session was so remarkable that I had to tell you all about it and recommend you consider doing it. I loved it and raved about it so much that Lisa, who works behind the scenes here at BPP doing marketing and booking guests and whatnot, she signed up for it and was so blown away that she's going to continue working with Kara on a regular basis. So check it out. See if it resonates with you. Again, it's called Manifesting Blueprint. And in this session, you learn about your gifts and talents, how you are structured to create and thrive, whether you are currently living consistent with your gifts, talents, and structure, and steps you can take to live consistent with who you are and how you are structured and bring forth what it is that you are wanting. As Kara describes, we all have innate gifts and talents. When you use those gifts and talents, you step into abundance. Life energizes you instead of depletes you, and then you thrive. So check it out. You can learn more at KaraNicoleBitar.com. That's KaraNicoleBitar, B as in boy, ITAR.com. And then click on optimization sessions to learn about this. And we will put that in the episode notes. Okay, we have got a huge show for you guys this week. Aaron, tell us who we have today.
Brad Aronson is the author of national bestseller Humankind, Changing the World One Small Act at a Time. All proceeds from his book go to Big Brothers Big Sisters. Brad is deeply involved with youth nonprofits, and he's on the boards of Big Brothers Big Sisters and HopeWorks. Brad also teaches entrepreneurship to students in Camden, New Jersey. Everyone in his class starts their own business, which has led to many adventures in entrepreneurship. Brad and his family, his wife, Mia, their son, Jack, and their dog, Perry, live in Philadelphia.
Not only is Brad's book a Wall Street Journal and USA Today bestseller, Forbes called it the most uplifting and life-affirming book in years. And you know you've written a powerful book when Deepak Chopra raves about it. So if you haven't read it yet, pick up a copy, and you might want to have some tissues ready. It's that powerful. So It was such an honor to have Brett on, and we talk about the power of kindness. We talk about what kindness means to him, how it affects us physiologically when we do acts of kindness. And you're going to love the stories that he shares from his book. Here it is, my conversation with Brad Aaronson.
Make the world a better place. Make the world a better place.
Welcome to the show, Brad. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
We're so excited to have you. I'd like to dive right in if we could. If you could tell, you talk a little bit about in your interviews, in your book, about the influence that your mom had on your life. And she said something to you that has stuck with you all these years. Can you share that with us?
Yes. So when we were growing up, we grew up in a beautiful suburb where, you know, to my young eyes, everything seemed perfect. And at one point, my mom said to me and my brother, "You guys have it great, and you have no idea how great you have it. You need to volunteer somewhere. Choose some place you want to volunteer."
Love.
And I chose a place that it was a place called Buddies. That was the program for kids in elementary school who had been through some sort of trauma. And I was in junior high at the time, and I would go after school and play tag or kickball and hang out. And then all of a sudden, I realized that these poor little kids had some really unfortunate luck happen to them. And it was completely random and unfair and undeserved. And it really did make me realize how lucky I was. And I also discovered that I loved volunteering. I loved hanging out with these kids. I loved playing with them. And I also felt this sense of wanting to do more because of the gifts I was given. And that's what got me started with volunteering and getting engaged in the community.
And, you know, you already touched upon something that I think is so important about, you know, what you write about in your book, but what kindness does in doing an act of service for somebody else. The first thing you talk about almost within your first or second sentence is how it made you feel, not the people that you were supposed to go out and help and serve and pick your charity and go do something for this foundation or what have you. Immediately, it had an effect on you. So did that motivate you to keep going, it sounds like, and do more acts of service?
It's this incredible byproduct that I did not expect. I did not expect that volunteering would make me feel so good. And I've looked at research. There is a significant amount of research that most people feel better, happier, more satisfied when they volunteer. And I've seen this with my students. I teach... a lot of my students have been through a lot of trauma. And when we do a service project for others, they feel incredible and they feel great and they feel empowered. So there is that byproduct, thank heavens, that keeps people engaged and excited about volunteering.
And what I love about it, these students that you're talking about, these are, if I remember right, in what, like the 18 to 25 year range or 16 to, they're young adults, are they not?
Yes, 18 to 25.
Okay, perfect. And is not one of the other kind of principles or one of the other kind of ideas behind your foundation is they also start enterprises or some sort of organization on their own, do they not? And you help them in that area?
Yeah, so I teach entrepreneurship. And these young entrepreneurs have had to be entrepreneurs to survive. They've had to hustle. They've had, a lot of them have had really bad things happen to them, and they've had to overcome it, pick themselves up. And if you want to be an entrepreneur, you know, you've got to be able to take a beating and get back up and keep going. So naturally, they are well-suited to be entrepreneurs. And in the class, if they don't have a business, every student starts their own business. If they have a business, we strategize and take steps to grow it. And it's a great way to build confidence. For some of them, it's built careers where they can keep these businesses and run them. And for others, it's given them an amazing story to tell employers that differentiates them from everyone else applying for that job.
You just telling me that, it completely made me think of one of my favorite Winston Churchill quotes of all time about success. And his definition of success is going from one failure to another without a loss of enthusiasm. And I just love that. If that doesn't, I'm an entrepreneur as well, started two companies. And if that doesn't sum it up, I mean, because every entrepreneur has had 5 to 10 times the amount of failures, you know, contrasting to their successes. So your ability, like you said, to brush yourself off, get back up and go on is one of the key ingredients to success, for sure.
Right. And it's tough because the media so often talks about the success and doesn't cover the hundreds of failures that led up to it. So young entrepreneurs think, oh my goodness, I should have this success already.
And not only do they talk about this success, but it's always an overnight success story.
Yes.
You know, by somebody who's 29 years old and did this and started this company and 2 years later, but they don't tell you about the previous 10 years when they were waiting tables till 2 a.m. and then getting up and selling their t-shirts out of the back of their car or what have you. Yeah, that's exactly right. So, well, I love it. Let's dive right into the book. As we mentioned in the intro, it's Humankind, Changing the World, One Small Act at a Time. And what I love about this book, Brad, is not only does it just make you feel amazing and inspired as you're reading all these short stories, and it's such a wonderful, easy book to read because it's every story is half a page to a couple pages long. So they're quick little short stories and you can keep it on your nightstand after you've done reading it for years. And before you go to bed, what better way to read a short little story about good humans doing good things in the world to inspire you? So it's just a gem of a book that I just cannot emphasize enough how amazing this book is and how good it is for the world, especially. And I understand you finished this book, unbeknownst to you, right after you finished it and you were getting ready to go out and do book tours, the pandemic hit. I think the universe will, you know, plan that out for this book to come out when we needed it most, perhaps. Any comments on that?
So
on the timing of it all?
The timing was completely random. So my book was assigned over a year in advance. It was assigned a publication date. And I remember the publisher told me it's April 14th. And I said, I don't know if April 14th is a good day because it's the right when taxes are due. People will be distracted. And they said,
And angry and mad.
Right.
I owe money. I don't want to talk about kindness.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And the publisher said, well, that's your date. I was like, okay. Then, you know, fast forward to a couple weeks before my book's supposed to come out. And all of a sudden, pandemics hit. Everything's going to lockdown. And I called the publisher and said, okay, my book's in all these bookstores. No one can go to bookstores. Every speaking event has been canceled. Maybe we should put off launching the book because there's no way to reach people. And they said, we have other authors. They have other dates. You know, this is your date. We're going to do it.
Wow.
And thank heavens they did, because it does turn out that people really wanted something to make them feel good and see the positive that others are doing and realize that they themselves through little acts of kindness could change a life. So the timing was, you know, I wish there was no pandemic, but it did turn out to be a good time for the book.
Absolutely.
And you know, all the proceeds from the book go to charity. So people could also feel good investing in it. And then hopefully it inspires them to go out and make their own change in the world.
And that charity, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, is Big Brother, Big Sister, which you've been a part of and you're on the board, correct?
Yes, yes. I love Big Brothers, Big Sisters.
Yeah, it's a wonderful, wonderful program as well. So I could do a whole episode just on that. So we may have to have you back another time just to talk about your work just there. So, because it's just a wonderful program. But for now, let's dive into the book. And if we could talk about a couple of my favorite stories from the book that really, really touched me. And one story in particular, as I'm reading it, about a little boy named Jimmy. And I'm reading this story and I'm thinking, gosh, what an incredible story. And I'm hearing about the teacher. Was it Mr. Clarkson, if I'm not mistaken? And then I'm as you get further along in the story, I'm like, wait a minute, I know who Jimmy is. So tell us the story about Jimmy.
All right. So Jimmy grew up in Flint, Michigan. And when he was in third grade, all he wanted to do was fly under the radar and not be noticed. But it was really hard for him. For one thing, he was the only kid in the entire third grade who came to school with his shoes tied in a huge jumble of knots. And that's because he's also the only kid. He was the only kid in the third grade who couldn't tie his shoes. And he was mortified that if his shoes came untied, he would have to ask a teacher for help. So he lived with having this jumble of knots. The reason why Jimmy was the only kid who couldn't tie his own shoes is because he had something that made him very different than all the other kids in the class. he had only one hand. And it was hard for him. Like, some kids would tease him and call him Captain Hook. One of his classmates burst out into tears on the first day because they thought his prosthetic hand was so scary. So obviously, flying under the radar was not something that Jimmy was successful at doing. One day he gets to school. Mr. Clarkson's sitting outside the classroom. He says, "Jimmy, I figured it out." "What'd you figure out, Mr. Clarkson?" "I'll show you." And Mr. Clarkson turned on a movie for the rest of the class, turned out the lights, and brought two chairs out into the hall. And he proceeded to teach Jimmy how to tie his shoes with one hand. Decades later, Jim said, "I don't know if it took Mr. Clarkson 20 minutes or hours to learn how to tie his shoes with one hand. And it doesn't matter. The fact that he did it was one of the most important points in my life, a turning point. It showed me that I could do anything I wanted to do if I put my mind to it, if I put the effort in." And Jimmy wanted to play baseball. So he practiced baseball all the time. In fact, he wound up leading the United States Olympic team to a gold medal in baseball as our pitcher.
And that's so awesome.
It is. It's unbelievable. When he became really well known, once he joined the professional league, people started showing up at his games. Parents would show up with their children who had disabilities looking for encouragement. And Jim tried.
And if I could jump in there, yeah. If I could jump in there for our listeners, not only did he join the professional league. So, I mean, you can become a professional baseball player and play in, you know, AA baseball or AAA baseball. There are all kinds of professional leagues. He made it to the big leagues. He played Dodger Stadium. He played for the Angels. He played for, I think, the Yankees, and had a 10-year career at the highest level of baseball. So I had to jump in because I'm so excited as I'm reading this. I'm going, oh my God, that's Jim Abbott. That has to be Jim Abbott.
Yes.
And then, of course, you disclosed in the book that it's Jim Abbott.
And he pitched a no-hitter. As you're saying, like, he was amazing, and he met with every family he could. And he did everything to support these kids. He would speak at events. He would raise money. He would raise awareness. I don't know if there's time. I could continue and talk about one of the kids that he reached.
I not only do I say yes to that, I insist on it, because to me, this is one of, in my opinion, one of the most under-talked about things when the conversation of kindness comes up. We all talk about amazing acts like what you just talked about right there. But what I don't think we talk about enough, and I think it's so important because so many of us, including myself, think, wow, what difference can I make in the world? I'm just one guy. I'm not a big star. I'm not a, but one act of kindness, I really want to talk about the ripple effect that can have. And that's one of the reasons why I love this story. So please continue on and talk about just that.
All right. So Jim is getting hundreds of letters a week, hundreds. And he and someone else in his ball club answered every single letter. And he would meet with all these families. One of the kids he met was Nick Newell. When Nick was 6 years old, his grandparents brought him to a Yankee game. And of course, Nick got to go to a meet and greet and meet Jim Abbott. And Nick told me, he said, "This was amazing. This was the first time I ever met anyone else who had only one hand. And he pitched for my favorite baseball team. And he told me I could be whatever I wanted to be." And Nick wanted to be a wrestler. And he would practice wrestling. In high school, he started wrestling for his high school team. He lost his first 17 matches by getting pinned. And for any listeners who don't follow wrestling, getting pinned is the worst way to lose a wrestling match.
Yeah, exactly.
But he got progressively better. And by senior year, he was captain of his team. He had records. He went on to captain his college wrestling team. And then he started competing in mixed martial arts and discovered that he liked that more. And he lost his first competition, won his next 13. Then he applied to compete in the UFC. And Dana White, who ran the UFC at the time, said, "It's hard enough to compete here with two hands. I'd be crazy to let someone compete with one hand." So Nick, he joined a different league, became a world champion. And he said that once he became well-known, parents started seeking him out, asking him, like, "What should I do to encourage my child who has a disability?" And Nick said he's met with every family he can. And Nick regularly speaks at events for kids who have lost all or part of an upper limb as a way to inspire them and encourage them. And Nick's a busy guy. So he has a young kid he's raising. He has a fledgling business, a gym, and you know it's hard to have a business.
And sure is, yeah.
He still competes in mixed martial arts. And I said, what? How do you make time to meet with all these kids, and what do you tell them? And he says, Jim Abbott wasn't too important to talk to me as a six-year-old. And he taught me that I'm not too important to talk to anyone else. I encourage all these kids. I tell them they could be what they want to be. And sometimes I teach them how to tie their shoes with one hand. And it goes back to what you were saying. I mean, Don Clarkson didn't think he'd make this huge sea of change. He saw a kid who wanted to fit in and thought he'd help him out. Mm-hmm. And now tens of thousands of kids have benefited from that.
Yeah, and I look at it as like almost a generational thing from Mr. Clarkson, then down to Jim Abbott, then to another six-year-old, and now he's gone up to be a UFC fighter and he's influences others. It, like you said, it's a sea of change, and this wasn't a multimillionaire donating money to a foundation. It wasn't. This was a school teacher that saw on his own a child, recognized it, had an awareness that we're going to talk about a little bit later, but had an awareness of a need of this child and felt a need to step in and went home and learned how to tie his shoes with one hand, even though he had two hands. And then the next day taught the child how to do it. Like you said, that one act and the sea of change that you just talked about is so moving and so powerful. Love, love, love it. And if I'm not mistaken, did you not eventually make it back to his wife and share that with her, the teacher's wife, if I'm not mistaken, years later?
I did track down Mr. Clarkson's wife. He had passed away when I was writing this. And she had known about some of this impact and had said that her husband, he was a rocket scientist before he became a teacher. And
really?
He had a physical disability and was just very aware of other people and how he could try to help them.
Okay.
And, you know, because of that, he contributed to helping to Jim Abbott to get where he wanted to go.
Sure did. And can we jump to another one that I love, the Hilde Back story?
Oh, yes.
Which is another wonderful, wonderful, wonderful one. Goes back to, well, I'll let you tell the story. You tell it way better than I can.
Maybe, you know, if you tell it, we could do a judge. We could judge that.
I could try and you can cut me off, but all right, let me try. And you can do the color commentary. All right. Hilde Back was a little child during the Holocaust, and she was, living in Germany, and her parents, so I'm trying to remember this. You really put me on the spot, but I'm accepting this challenge.
All right. And I don't have to put you on the spot. If you could tag out.
Oh, no. I'll probably tap out at any time to use the UFC term. But the Holocaust is starting to occur. The family flees to Sweden or Switzerland.
Sweden.
I believe it was Sweden. To Sweden. The daughter is let in. She's 17 at the time. Hilde is let in. But the parents are sent back. And unfortunately, they're left in the they ended up dying in the gas chambers, unfortunately. So Hilde grows on, and rather than being sad and you know about everything that happened to her life, losing her parents, she goes on to start doing acts of kindness and acts of service, and she started contributing to. In fact, yeah, I'm going to turn it over to you because you're a way better storyteller,
right,
at least on this story. So pick it up from where I left off.
So I'll pick it up, and just to also go back a little bit
and fix my errors. Yes.
No. Just like there's something I love is that Hilde's community in Germany felt so bad about what the Nazis were doing, but didn't see how they could help. And I think this is important for people to see. Like sometimes you're in a situation and they said, we can't change what the Nazis are doing. We can't change what's going to happen, but we could help one family. And they got the money together so that Hilde can afford to go to Sweden. She said that she always felt like she wanted to do things, especially for people from other countries, because when she came to Sweden, people helped her. When she got to Sweden, she became a nanny, and then she became a school teacher, and she found this charity where she could donate $45 a year to pay for the secondary school education of a child in Kenya. Because in Kenya, primary school is free, but secondary school at the time was $45 a year. And what would basically happen is if you're in poverty, you drop out of school. You wind up working alongside your parents, and it's just a cycle that continues for your family. Well, her donation wound up paying for the secondary school education of a child named Chris Maburu. And Chris told me about the village where he grew up. It was very rural, very poor. After primary school, the kids generally worked in the fields alongside their parents. If someone got sick, they couldn't get medical care. There's no money for that. If you missed an extended period of work, your family was hungry because there just wasn't enough money. But he had this scholarship, so he got to go to secondary school, and he excelled there. Then he went to University of Nairobi, because in Kenya, even though secondary school costs money, college is free. He did so well at University of Nairobi that he got a scholarship to Harvard. And upon graduation, he became an international human rights lawyer for the United Nations, working in genocide, not even knowing Hilda's background. And he told me that he felt so guilty when he went back to his village because his peers and his friends were all working in the fields alongside their parents. And Chris said they didn't have, in his view, they didn't have the future he had. And it wasn't because Chris was smarter than them. It was because there just weren't enough scholarships, and he was one of the lucky kids who got one. And Chris never met Hilda, but one of the early letters from the nonprofit mentioned her name. So he decided he would set up a nonprofit and name it after her. So he started
so cool.
It is amazing. He started the Hilda Back Education Fund to pay for the secondary school education of children in his area. And so far, it's helped over 900 kids get a secondary school education, which pulls a whole family out of poverty.
Absolutely. In fact, I have queued up a quote from your book, if I could read just a little quote that Chris talked about, and he's talking about Hilda here. He says, "She was an angel who walked into my life and fixed it." He said the $15 she sent every school term, $45 a year, like you said, is what made him who he is. Some stranger walked into my life and changed it. Hilda gave me hope. I kept coming back to the village and seeing that these people that I went to school with who had not been able to continue with their studies, and I saw where they were in their lives. For them, the angel had not appeared. To read a little bit further in the book, going over what you were just saying, Chris is doing something about that. At age 53, he's an international human rights lawyer serving with the United Nations as a senior human rights advisor. He's also the founder of a nonprofit that assists with education funding for Kenyan children living in poverty. In his spare time, he advocates for governments around the world to provide free education as a basic human right. And he raised awareness through events in more than a dozen countries last year. And he says, quote, "I want to see a world in which children have equal opportunity and are not robbed of their future by poverty like so many of my friends in the village were." The ripple effect, Brad. This is one woman in Sweden, $15 every 4 months, $45 a year, which that's maybe even what the inflation equivalent to, maybe $25 or $30 every 4 months now. It's, and the difference that it made in one man's life who's now making a difference in maybe hundreds or thousands of lives, the ripple effect. We can all make a difference with simple acts of kindness starting now. Love it. Anything else to add on that one?
Yes. So, and that ripple continued. So two of the kids who got scholarships from Chris's nonprofit started their own nonprofit in Mombasa, which is Kenya's second largest city. And their nonprofit pays for the secondary school education of children in Mombasa.
Jeez.
Then on top of that, Kathleen Ismail, she is a woman who volunteered in Ghana. And she told me that when she heard Chris and Hilda's story, she realized that they were normal people just like her. Like, that was her quote. They were normal just like me. And if they could do that, I could do something. And she started a scholarship program in Ghana that provided over 200 scholarships for children. So these ripples continue. Jeez. And what's amazing is Hilda actually got to see her legacy. So she visited the village and was made a tribal elder, which is a huge honor. And Chris said she became like a mom to him, that he would see her at least once a year and thought of her as a second mom. And she said in an interview, I always wondered what happened to that money and if it evaporated. And she's really lucky. Most people don't see the impact they have. But boy, she got to see this.
And we all think that, don't we? When I've donated some money to a to an organization, I kind of wonder in the back of my mind, is it really helping somebody? And yeah, and she admits that in your book. Like, I didn't really know. But what I love about it, she kept year after year sending that money and without ever really knowing. And then just all these years to see that the legacy of what she had done over that that small act is just such a beautiful, beautiful, wonderful story. Another one of my favorites. Let's share one more if we could. The Menders and Barb Lappin. Can you talk a little bit about that one?
Yes, yes. And they're from Philadelphia, which is my home city. So I got to visit with them, which is awesome. So when Barb was retired, she wanted to find something to do. And one day at church, someone came in and spoke about this program for the homeless that that is down in Philadelphia. And she thought, ah, you know what? I could get into that. And she just went to visit and talked to the person who ran it and said, hey, I'd like to, you know, set up a program where maybe I love sewing. I could sew up people's clothes and bags that are ripped. And they're like, okay, well, why don't you ask people if they need it? So she goes in and they have this big dining room where they serve people. A lot of homeless people come in for meals regularly.
Sure.
They have their mailboxes there. They can shower there. A lot of services there. And she started walking around the table and say, hey, you know, do you need Menders? And no one knew what she was talking about. Like, Menders? What are you talking about? He's like, you know, I could sew your stuff. And one guy picks up his sleeve and he's like, this? And he's got like his sleeves broke. So it's like my pockets. She's like, yeah. And they're like, we would love it. So she got together. She announced it to her group at church. And this bunch of grandmas come into Philadelphia now twice a week. They set up shop. And the people who are suffering from homelessness, they come in with their bags, with their pants. And I mean, if you're homeless, your bag is – your whole life is in there. A rip could mean you lose all your stuff. And some of them, when they have job interviews, they get suits from these nonprofits, but they don't really fit right. And they could fix it, and they're so happy. And these women, it's not just that they're making the clothes. They're treating them like humans. And what I mean by that is the homeless people say that on the streets, people won't even look at them. They avoid
invisible.
Them. And here – someone's asking them how they're doing and even touching them on the shoulder and fixing their clothes. They feel like humans. And Barb told me about this one gentleman who came back years later and said, I just want you to know you fixed my clothes and my bag. And now I have a job and a house and everything is great. And it's amazing because these women come in from a suburb in Philadelphia into this area where they're helping all these homeless people, two completely different worlds. And it's beautiful. I hope that when I am a grandpa, I am doing something like that.
Amen. Again, another beautiful story. And what I liked about that story is that for some of us out there or some listeners out there listening, thinking, you know what, I don't even have $15 even now to send, you know, to an organization like Hilda did. But what I love about that story is this was somebody that just said, in fact, I remember in the book, she even says, you know, a lot of people like to, you know, make food for the, you know, but that didn't really resonate with me. But I thought, I know how to sew. Maybe that can be a value. So many of us out there, we have little skills that we can use that can be a value and make a huge difference, as was the case with Barb. So another great, great story. And if we could switch gears a little bit and still stay within the book and talk about how kindness can come in all different shapes and forms, can you share the story of the leaf blower at the Ronald McDonald Camp?
Yes.
Because yes. I love that story.
Thank you. You know what? I love that too. That was such a learning moment for me. So Ronald McDonald Camp is a camp for kids who have cancer and their siblings. And I was a volunteer counselor there. My first year, I get up to camp. The counselors get there early because it's a week-long sleepover camp. And you're unpacking your bunk. And I noticed that my co-counselor brought a leaf blower. So I'm thinking he must be crazy into being clean. Like, he's going to leaf
clean
blow the
freak,
bunk
yeah.
every day or something. I'm like, Jim, what's up with the leaf blower? I don't even know this guy. He turns to me and goes, oh, I wake up the kids with it. They love it. And I'm thinking, holy cow, like, this guy's a lunatic. But we'll see how it goes. So the next day, the campers get there, and you sit down all the campers on the first day, and you go through the rules. Like, don't touch anyone's stuff. You participate in all the activities. You don't exclude anyone. And then Jim pulls out his leaf blower and says, guys, if you don't wake up, I'm going to leaf blow you. And the kids are smiling nervously. And then look at me like, is this for real? And I'm like, I don't know. and at camp, we have this tradition called polar bear swim. We wake up the kids early in the morning. We take them up to the pool and everyone jumps in.
And this is like in the mountains, right? Where it's cold and in the morning. And
It is cold in the morning.
So that's not something they want to do, is go jump in the water right when they get up.
It's mixed. Some kids like it. Think it's an adventure. Yeah. Other kids, they don't want to get up and they don't want to jump in the pool. Midway through the week, not a single kid would get out of bed. Every kid wanted to be leaf blown. Because it wasn't that they loved being leaf blown so much. And then we'd all go up to the pool. They'd be laughing. They'd jump in. No one had a hard time with it anymore. Jim didn't accept that, you know what? Some kids just won't like this. He thought, I could change the whole tone and make it fun. And he did. And the lesson to me, there's so many lessons from Ronald McDonald Camp that I got. And one that I saw repeatedly was, when something isn't fun, we should always ask ourselves, why not? How can we change the story to make it different? And, of course, when I got home and I told my son about the leaf blowing, he insisted I wake him up with a leaf blower. We did that.
Dad,
for about a month.
I got to do that too. Yeah, that's so awesome. And I had forgotten about this story until you just triggered me when you said it. When you make it fun, you can help a negative experience. And I don't remember, honestly, if this is in the book or I heard it in one of your interviews, but you talked about kids that are I believe it was treatment for cancer. They're in chemotherapy. They're in the hospital going through a tough time. And they did a program where they would put on like a disco ball when it came time for their medicine, which kids don't want medicine. Do you recall that story?
Yes.
Can you share that real quickly with us?
Absolutely.
As well?
So that's also
great example of that.
That's also from Ronald McDonald Camp.
Oh, it is. Okay. Yes. Okay.
So basically the kids who have cancer have to take medicine, most of them, a lot of times during the day. And at night, as a bunk counselor, I would take the kids in my bunk who needed medicine to the wellness center. Generally, the kids didn't like taking the medicine. It made their hair fall out. It made them feel like vomiting. Makes you feel blah. So they don't want to take their medicine. That first night, I get up to the wellness center. It's pitch black, except for this giant disco ball. And it's spinning around. And the music is so loud. And the staff says, you can't have your medicine unless you dance for it. And the kids are dancing and they're having fun. And every night after that, they were looking forward to getting their medicine. And silly me, I would have thought, well, it's just not going to be fun for them because it makes them feel sick. But thank heavens, the wellness staff said, why not? Why can't this
beautiful.
Be fun?
Can we talk a little bit about what is kindness? And when I was preparing for this interview over the last couple of days, I was curious. I Googled kindness, and I went to dictionary.com and Oxford Dictionary, and they list kindness as the quality of being friendly, generous, and considerate. And it was interesting. I was also taken to a webpage by it's myfoothold.org, and a cognitive behavioral hypnotherapist named Andy Thornton wrote a little blog on this. And he listed this as well, the definition of kindness, the quality of being friendly, generous, and considerate. And this is what he said. Interestingly, the "and" indicates that all three of those conditions are required for kindness to be present. So one can be friendly and yet not kind, or both generous and considerate but not kind. Perhaps it's when we become aware of all three conditions being present that we feel for ourselves the pleasure of real kindness. And I really love that, especially, in the context of like when we talk about Mr. Clarkson and Jim Abbott as a little boy, it's the awareness that he had of someone in need that I think separates kindness from simply being nice. And he goes on to say, or in fact, I take this back. This is from a different site, inspiredkindness.com, said, kindness goes beyond merely being nice. Think about it. Would you prefer people to describe you to be kind or nice? There can be a lack of sincerity in just being nice. there's often a perception of doing the minimum, whereas being kind is doing intentional, voluntary acts of kindness, not only when it's easy to be kind, but when it's hard to be. What does kindness mean to you, Brad?
So I think kindness is looking around and noticing those opportunities where you can do something. Like so often we might see something and think, oh man, I feel really bad for that person. Or I really hope things go well. And kindness is taking the next step and saying, I really feel for that person. I'm going to send them a letter. I'm going to drop off a cupcake and doing something with that. And I think once you start down that path, you can think of yourself as a superhero and just look around every day and say, how am I going to make someone's day today? And then you find these little ways to make a difference. But I do think kindness is about being intentional. It's about being able to see when someone is in need and then taking action to do something about that. And not for yourself, but for that person.
And if we could also circle back to, at the very beginning of this conversation, we talked about how it made you feel when you were a young boy and you went and played kickball with some of these kids and whatnot. And so I wanted to talk just for a second, and this I also read on myfoothold.org on a blog that's out there that talks about kind of the physiological things that happen to us when we practice kindness. And he writes, when we practice kindness either to other people or towards ourselves, we can experience positive mental and physical changes through lowering stress levels and increasing the body's production of feel-good hormones such as dopamine, oxytocin, and serotonin. Being kind helps boost the immune system, reduce blood pressure, and reduce stress and anxiety. I love that. So if there aren't 100 great ways to be kind, there's another, or great reasons to be kind. I mean, there's another great reason to be kind because it's good for you. It makes you feel good. It makes your health, it lowers your blood pressure. It makes you a human being. It makes you feel better. It makes you enjoy life more. I love that. Anything to add?
No, I think that sums it up perfectly. Like there's a lot of benefits and the world really needs it. And we need it as people when we're going through such stressful, challenging, difficult times as the world is going through now. Like we need people to be kind to each other and we need to be kind to other people.
Totally agree. And I also wanted to touch a little bit on this because I think this is also talked about way too little. And that is the importance of being kind to yourself. And this is also something I read from myfoothold.org. Being kind to yourself is not just a nice idea. It's an essential form of self-care and a vital foundation for sustained kindness to others. Remember those aircraft safety briefings that stress the importance of putting on your own oxygen mask before helping others? Well, kindness to yourself is a bit like that. And I love that. So what are some things, Brad, that you do to show kindness to yourself?
So I think it's hard in general for people to be kind to ourselves. And we're just harsh on ourselves. And sometimes I try to say, if a friend came to me with this, what would I tell them? And I realize I would not be telling them the same story that I'm telling myself. So it's important to cut myself some slack.
So true. I just recently read a book by Jen Sincero called You Are a Badass. And she says exactly what you just said, Brad. And one of the things I've tried to work on the last couple of years is I realized about a year or so ago that there was still a lot of negative self-talk in my head when I would throughout the day so hard on myself. And she said exactly what you said. When you do something wrong, would you talk to your best friend or your spouse the way you talk to yourself? Would you say because you forgot your car keys or because you forgot your wallet to go to an important meeting like happened to you? And, you know, I don't know if we have time for that story, but I love that one as well. But would you say, oh, you know, if I were with you in the car, would I say, Brad, you're an idiot. Why wouldn't you remember your wallet with your ID? You're going to an important meeting with the CEO. Of course I wouldn't do that, but we do that to ourselves all the time. Not only do we not practice kindness to ourselves, we're so hard on ourselves. And since I've been, and we had a gentleman, Dr. Shad Helmstetter, on the show last year, who's been on Oprah many times, and he's written a bunch of books on positive self-talk. When he talked about this, and we spent an hour, and he said, pay attention to all your thoughts throughout the day. Do it for one day. And oh my gosh, was it an eye-opener for me on how much negative self-talk is out there, you know, or is in my own head. So I think I'm probably not the only one. So I really wanted to take a moment and pause here to, you know, to really touch upon this, because that made a huge difference in my life when I finally made myself aware of every thought in my head throughout the day and started being kinder and gentler to myself. Then it was so much easier. I was in a better mood, and it was so much easier to be kinder and gentler to others.
You got it.
Yeah. Anyway, love, love, love it. So any other techniques that you would suggest for our listeners on just the way to be kind to yourself, to do special things for yourself?
I mean, I think everyone should schedule time for the things that mean a lot to you, because we become so scheduled in our calendar and we tend to push our own things off. Because I don't, you know, if working out makes you feel great, you might not put it on your calendar. When everything gets filled up, you just don't work out. Whatever's important to you, if it's taking a walk, if it's reading a book, if it's working out, like, put that in your calendar. Make that sacred time. Because Steve, you're totally right. If we are not centered and we're not being kind to ourselves, we can't possibly be kind to other people. We got too much going on in our heads. We're too flustered.
That's exactly right. Totally agree. And if we could also, I want to point out, because we're running out of time here, I apologize for running late. I've so enjoyed this conversation, but I wanted to point out at the end of the book, and I recommend everybody pick up a copy of The Humankind. I'll tell you where you can get it in a minute, of Humankind, Changing the World One Small Act at a Time. In the back of the book, there's the Humankind Hall of Fame, where Brad lists a bunch of incredible organizations. And one you list in there is Comfort Cases and Rob Shear, who is our very first guest on the show. And as I mentioned, I have a soft spot for foster families, and his organization is outstanding. So I want to throw out a plug to them. But any other organizations out there within the Hall of Fame that you'd like to point out as well? Obviously, Big Brother and Big Sister.
I mean, there's so many good ones in there. You know, I'm biased because I put it together. But I'll mention like two of my favorites and why they're my favorites.
Please.
One is Love for Our Elders. And this is a nonprofit that is trying to help seniors who are lonely. And you send them letters and they distribute it to lonely seniors. I love how it started. It got started by this kid, Jacob Kramer, when he was 13 years old. He had a really great relationship with his grandfather. And when his grandfather died, he wanted to do something to honor him. So he started volunteering at a senior home and saw how lonely people were who often had no visitors. So he started writing them letters and they loved it. So then he got other people to start writing letters. And now he has 50,000 volunteers. They distribute hundreds of thousands of letters a year in multiple languages, in multiple countries. The letters get sent to the nonprofit and they distribute them. And it's just, it's really nice, because here's someone who saw a need, decided to fill it himself just by writing some letters. And here's what it's become.
Beautiful.
Which is great. And I think you'll like this one, One Simple Wish.
Oh,
yeah. It's a nonprofit where social workers post the wishes of their clients who are foster youth. Because often if you're a foster youth, there might not be money for music lessons or sporting equipment or the birthday gift you want. And the social workers post the wishes on the site and we can fulfill them. We could put a dollar towards a wish, or we could fulfill an entire wish. And it's something nice to do with your kids also. So around the holidays, I love my son, you know, we would get on, he'd be like, all right, I want to see what like other 11-year-old boys are interested in. And it helps him just kind of see a little bit beyond what he's doing. And it's a great way to make it a special holiday for someone or to help pay for those lessons or tutoring or whatever they might need.
Love, love it. And lastly, our final signature question, and I feel like you've answered this about 50 times already in this interview, but just in the event you have anything else to add, what advice do you have for us and our listeners on how we can help make the world a better place?
Just do it, to quote Nike. I think, you know, we all see these opportunities where our heart is moved. Take that step. Like, to share one thing, my book is about small acts of kindness that change lives. So I talked to hundreds of people who were going through really rough times because they needed a small act to change their lives. And sure, there's one thing that every single person agreed on that was important, like when they felt like they were seen. And so often we might know someone in our own circle is going through a rough time and we don't reach out to them because we think it's awkward or we don't know what to say. What I heard, right, the only thing everyone agreed on was that it made a huge difference. And they didn't want to talk about their problem, just someone writing a note saying, hey, thinking of you, or I thought you might like this magazine article. It's just that you knew they were there. And that's something we could all do.
I care. You matter.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Love, love, love it. And the book is, in fact, before we wrap up, if I could just read one little snippet from the back of your book that I absolutely love, and I think it's a great way to wrap up our call today. And you mentioned a quick little interaction between Mia, your wife, and Jack, your son. Mia says, let's come up with a plan for today. Jack says, I have one to be awesome. And then you write, I love that plan and have made it my own. Why not think bigger than our daily routines and crossing items off our to-do list? Each of us has the power to be awesome every day. If you say to yourself, I'm going to make someone's world better today, it will happen. All it takes is looking for opportunity, following through, and that resource we all have within us, love. Brad, thank you so much. The book for our listeners is Humankind, Changing the World, One Small Act at a Time. It's a Wall Street Journal and USA Today bestseller. You can find anything about Brad at his website and order the book at bradaronson.com. That's BRADARONSON.com. And we will put all that in the episode notes. Brad, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. This was really fun.
Special thanks to our guest, Brad Aronson. To learn more about him and the work he is doing, you can visit bradaronson.com. Thanks to our producer, Noah Existen, editor, Joe Taupoco. Our music was written and performed by Nadia Importante. Thank you so much for listening. If this podcast brightened your day in any way, please subscribe and leave us a review. If you have any ideas of guests or suggestions on how we can improve our show, please email us at betterplaceprojectpodcast@gmail.com. For updates on our show, you can follow us on Instagram at BetterPlaceProj or head to our website, betterplaceproject.org. Look for small ways to be kind to others this week, and that will help make the world a better place.
Make the world a better place. Make the world.